Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining the 39th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we will visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as new Mainers. Today, my guest is John, who was originally from Eastern DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. He is a minister who worked in Rwanda after the genocide to bring about healing through a practice called restorative justice. Restorative justice involves victims with their offenders to find an alternative path to justice, answering questions, repairing harm, and creating more peace. Thank you for coming in today, John.
Thank you, Kate.
Much of what we are going to talk about today, related to your experiences, was set in Rwanda, the country which neighbors your region of Eastern Congo. And I wonder if you could tell us what you saw in Rwanda in the years after the genocide.
Thank you, Kate. It's huge. And hard things I saw, it will not be easy to say it in a few words. But I will try to summarize and to tell you the major issues about the after 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where officials reported said 1,800,000 people died, killed by the neighbors, by the militias and the soldiers of the government at that time. After genocide, there was horror and trauma. Streets were just filled with bones and skulls and blood, and there is a spirit of fear of death in the air. Everyone, almost the country, was traumatized. There was a need to bring back lives by rebuilding peace and creating trust among people, as well tracking the offenders and be able to bring them into justice. This was not an easy thing.
This all happened over a rather short period of time in 1994, didn't it? The 800,000 to a million deaths.
Yes, that's true. The newspaper said it was 3 months, 100 days, where that around 1 million people were massacred. It's a very, very short time.
It is. I'm sure the death was everywhere.
Everywhere. Even where you can't see. Up to now, they are discovering people who have been dumped in a mass grave 20 years after. So death was everywhere.
When you started going to Rwanda, years after, was it? Or was it right after that time or later?
It was after genocide. Actually, I started that work in 95.
So the following year you started going?
Yes.
And people were traumatized?
Very traumatized. Mm-hmm. Paralyzed by fear and hopelessness and sadness. Both suspect of genocide, offenders, as well victims. There was no hope. There was no real life.
I'm sure many services were interrupted and life as normal must have been interrupted if you take a million people out of your population in such a small country.
Not only 1 million who died, but more than 2 million went in exile, the suspect killers. So the country was almost empty, only dead bodies and those from out, especially Tutsi who went in exile in 1960s, 59, 61. They are the ones who were coming back from Tanzania, from Uganda, from Burundi, from Congo, Kenya, and other countries. But the Rwandan themselves almost has gone out of the country.
So you started going there. What caused you to go to Rwanda?
I was a prison chaplain in Goma, where almost a million of Hutu Rwandan were in exile, they free from the RPF rebels who took power at that time. And I encountered firsthand with people who did the genocide. They were in the prisons. But at the same time, there was a fear of those militia. They were still hunting Congolese Tutsi to kill them. They tried even to kill them. They killed some of them. So my security, even in Goma, was not guaranteed. So I was as well targeted and persecuted. So I left Goma in fear for my life. Actually, I was fleeing. But because I have started ministering to genocide offenders in prison of Congo, when I reached Rwanda, automatically I started visiting them in the prisons by their invitation, but because some of them were transferred from Congo to Rwanda prisons, and when I met them, they made a call that I may visit them, and I found it was a need. They need comfort, they need encouragement for life, and I right away started the ministry, going into prisons and to encourage them a path to healing, which has to pass by recognizing what they have done, repenting, confessing, and they found a way of hope and a life again.
Because people weren't going to be in prison forever, were they? Was there a limited sentence for someone who was in prison in Rwanda for the genocide killings?
At that time, prisoners did not hope to go out of the prisons. According to the magnitude of the crimes they have done, the people they have killed, they thought they would be killed too. But it was not easy to kill. If 1 million died, that means more than 4 million were involved in the killing. So it was not easy to kill all those people. And it was not easy to try them because there was no evidence for what they have done. So the process had to be long. Fortunately, Rwandan people thought about the Gacaca Code, which will speed up the trial and will reduce the sentence in case somebody accepts what he has done, confess it, and is willing to change.
I wonder if our listeners know the term Gacaca.
Gacaca courts or Gacaca jurisdictions is a community-based justice. Gacaca originally is grassroots, where men of the community, the village, and the elders used to sit to settle matters or conflict within the community, the people of the community. So they were inspired by those traditional Gacaca conflict transformation to set up jurisdictions for the offenders of genocide. That's why it was called Gacaca. It was an inspiration of the traditional way of dealing with conflict and crime in the communities long ago, before Western justice came into Africa.
And this was performed under a tree in the center of the village, right?
Yes, some villages it was under the tree. In Rwanda, it was on Gacaca. Rwanda is a small country, and I guess many villages for a long time didn't have trees and forest. So they have the out of the village, on the gate of the village, a place where there is only grassroots and reserved for people to sit in evening for talk or for solving issues, crime or conflict within families and individuals.
This is such a departure from the justice system we're familiar with. where if you commit a crime, you've committed a crime against the state. And in restorative justice, when you commit a crime, you've committed a crime against an individual or the community. Sounds like Gachacha is a way for the community to listen, to hear what happened, to ask questions, and see if they can come up with some solutions for fixing the problems after that.
Yes, restorative justice principles and philosophy was African philosophy of justice. It was a way of life of African people. The objectives of justice in African philosophy, it was to win both offenders and victims in the community, to create a sense of peace, safety, and security by trusting each member of the community. So it was more for reconciliation and for creating a reconnection between offenders and victims in the community than punishing. So it's an old concept of African. There was no prison in Africa before colonial time. So the community has to deal with both offenders and victims to bring them back into the community, but restoring a victim into his rights as much as possible.
That's a really important point. You know, the rights of the victim are valued, and it's an opportunity for the victim to have a say, right? And to ask some questions.
Yes.
Get those needs met, to figure out what happened and when and where.
Yes, it is important for the victim to have all the information from the offender himself, instead of rumors, people thinking, imagining what happened. It is an affirmation from the offender that the victim is not to blame, has nothing to do with what happened to him or to her. It is a time where the victim feels really innocent and empowered, and by the offender, by accepting what he has done, confessing it, and willing to amend himself. It's a healing path for the victims to trauma caused by the crime.
Did you see a lot of remorse in the offenders' stories? Were they sad for what they had done?
Yeah, some of them were very, very deeply sad and affected by what they have done. But I can say too also the trauma issues, because of the magnitude of what they have done, was a blockage to expression of their feelings. It was numb of expressing any feelings, because what they have done was sometimes beyond human understanding. Somebody who would have killed a nephew, a father-in-law, mother-in-law, and so many people that when he look back what he have done, he does not want even to think about it or to accept he has done it. So that will block all kind of emotions of sorrow and regret. But it's a process.
And you were there for that whole process, weren't you?
Yes.
John, you were featured in a documentary film called Rwanda, Living Forgiveness. And I'll put a link to this on the webpage. But what was it like to have your work captured on film?
The idea did not come from me of documenting what I've been doing. I was busy rebuilding lives and happy to see that some offenders and victims are coming to a path of healing and mutual trust and living together. But the idea came from people who want to know the stories of forgiveness. They was attracted by, it was the first time to see offenders of genocide and victims together and listening and telling the truth and sometimes reconciling. So to me, it was a way of broadcasting, let the public know what happened and what's happening in order probably to spread that truth and worldwide so that future conflict, future wars, future attempt of genocide should be prevented by people who knows what happened and what is happening.
In that film, I was most struck by the man who came out of prison. After 6 years, there was an opportunity if people were willing to confess their deeds, they could be out in the community and maybe do community support kinds of work to atone for their actions. And this one man went to the family member of the family, went to a person whose family members he had killed, and helped that person understand what had happened, and then helped that person rebuild the home that had been destroyed, and the buildings that had been destroyed on his property. Together they worked, side by side. I think that that is a concept that probably hasn't crossed most people's minds, and it takes a huge amount of courage. Did you see a number of stories like this?
Yes, many, many stories. And it was very beautiful to see that this kind of symbolic reparations comes from the hearts of offenders. They didn't believe that just confessing and telling the truth was enough to let victims and the community accept the apology and trust them again as a positive member of the community. So they initiated to do some work for victims, as Ezekiel, you are talking about. He's not alone. Many were suggesting, what can we do to the victims to assure them that we are sorry and really we want things to be changed. So most of them was willing to do something for the victim in order to confirm the apology, to affirm that they are really willing to live with the victims, even though they cannot really make reparation of what they have done.
So they were neighbors before, and then they were enemies, and then they go back to being neighbors.
Yes, that's the truth. Tutsi and the Hutu lived together in the same village. And when there is no political problem, they live together as friends. Sometimes they marry each other. They are related. But one morning, the Hutu wake up and killed on machete, on grenade, on spears. They neighbors, close neighbors, they have been living for centuries together, generation to generations. And sometimes related because they were intermarried. So it is an unusual thing which happened.
One woman on the film admitted she has no idea who is Hutu and who is Tutsi as the violence breaks out. She doesn't know, just at a glance, who's who.
On my personal opinion, I think that's because of some of the reason which caused genocide, the inferiority complex and the superiority complex.
The inferiority complex and the what?
Superiority complex.
Oh, superiority, sure.
So during the Hutu regime from 61 or 62 up to 94, Tutsi were so much persecuted that they wanted to change even their own identity. They want to assimilate to Hutu. Some even tried and get a Hutu identity in order to get the benefit as nationals. So I guess Tutsi, some Tutsi were trying to escape to be Tutsi. Otherwise, it is not easy. That's why they were almost all killed, to do not know that you are a Hutu or a Tutsi. But I think that generation of after 61 tried to hide or to escape to be Tutsi because it was dangerous. Otherwise, there is no other reason. You can say somebody who is 40 years can say he does not know if he is a Hutu or Tutsi. It's because of the political situation, which was somehow persecuting the Tutsi in one way or the other.
I'm curious what the most important thing that you learned about forgiveness might be in this process of working with victims and offenders after this genocide?
I learned that forgiveness is a gift. It's a gift out of deep wisdom of knowing self and knowing the other. Of course, it's supported by the fact that the offender is willing to tell the truth. The community is supporting the victim. And the offender is willing to change too and to make some amendment. This prompts the offender to recognize that human has failures and limitation and can go away from the right way of living, but have the capacity to come back also, to change and to be trusted again. So it's a deep wisdom, it's a strong character to be able to release forgiveness to someone who has killed parents or children or wife or husband or relatives. It is not usual. It's supernatural.
Supernatural.
Yes. It is not natural.
It feels like a gift outside of yourself.
Yes.
To be able to have that much
yes.
wisdom, that much courage to
yes.
forgive someone who's hurt you.
It
so
is
badly.
Not natural. It's not human.
How do you understand that? So say more about that. Where does this gift come from?
By observing the process. The process between offender and victims to forgiveness or to categorically not forgive. By hearing stories of the victims, how they come to forgiveness, understanding human heart and human mind is a process by hearing, by experimenting the behavior of those who went through such problems.
Do people have a choice whether they can participate in this program or not?
Yes.
So only if you're ready to hear the offender tell the story of how he killed your loved one would you be in that situation? You wouldn't have to go to this if you were not in a place that you wanted to hear this again and be
no.
re-traumatized.
No.
So it's voluntary.
You would not. Even those who were sometimes pushed to come by the neighbors or by the political will who wanted everyone in the country to come to a state of reconciliation, they came to the dialogue, they could go back weeping and crying. They could not finish the session. So it was by will. It was by choice. Even though the need was constraining many to participate, the choice was not much since the Gacaca Court had to release the offenders that will come to the community and live as neighbors.
That must have been very surprising when you see the offender walking down the street, someone who's hurt your family, and now he's out, and you see him in the community again for the first time.
Yes, some were more hurt and traumatized. I've had stories of people, by seeing the first time the neighbors, offenders, came back to the village, they fell down and lose consciousness for a while.
Passed out.
Mm-hmm. And those will flee the village and they go to hide somewhere else if he has a friend or relatives. So it was traumatizing for the first time. And I think that's why the offenders also were seeking all means to let victims in the community understand that they are still a human being. They are not monsters, and they are not coming back to kill again.
It's really important to establish that.
Yeah.
What is your dream today for the people of Rwanda with regards to healing and integrating back into a whole community?
My dreams for not only Rwanda, but all the region, because even like Congo is worse right now than Rwanda and other African countries like Nigeria or Sudan. My dream is about to educate people to peace and to rights and to obligations, to mature population that they may live in a state where they could not be under the submission of the state at the extent of killing their mother-in-law, their sister-in-law, their nephew and nieces. They may not be able to recognize that the neighbor is not a threat, is a benefit. So I think we need to deal most with the grassroots people, the community people, the young, the elder, the children, and then the rulers who are hungry for the power at all cost may not have people to use for killing each other.
To realize there's a different choice than just to follow
yes.
the leaders.
Like here in America or in other Western countries, it is not easy to tell a citizen to kill a neighbor without a reason. Is that possible here in America?
I think anything's possible, but I think what you're saying is you don't believe that the state should be telling you that.
So you can't stop the state. You can't stop the ruler to achieve his interest and dream power by killing a portion of the situation, because it's about wealth and power hungry. You can't stop anybody, but you can stop him only by cutting off the people he's using, the tools, the population, to be able to do not follow such kind of propaganda and orders.
So you support using the process of law?
Yes.
Wonderful. John, you have done so many very powerful things that required great courage in your work. Thank you for being willing to come on New Mainers Speak today and tell us about how you've used restorative justice to make some peace in the world.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You have been listening to New Mainers Speak, and we will close today's program with some traditional Congolese music. Thanks again, John, for coming in.
Thank you, Kate.